From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. After a contentious week of the 2024 presidential election, many African Americans gripped to their phones on the evening of November 5th, waiting for history to unfold, and that it did. The nation watched two electorates fighting for the future of America.
Are y'all ready to add your voice to the new American song?
Texas, what is happening across this state and our country is a healthcare crisis. And Donald Trump is the architect of it.
This is all you need to know. Kamala broke it. She broke it. We will fix it. I will fix it. It'll be fixed very fast.
Donald Trump, the 45th president of the United States, will be the 47th. Trump addressed supporters gathered in Florida around 2:30 this morning.
Frankly, this was, I believe, the greatest political movement of all time. There's never been anything like this in this country, and maybe beyond.
It's like Kamala ain't, like, take no stance on nothing. Like, she wasn't clear. Like, she didn't, like, she wasn't standing on nothing. Trump was at least standing on stuff. Like, he had clear. He told you what he was going to do, what he wanted.
On the left, you see this notion that a family can look like anything other than a man and a woman. And there are a lot of young men who don't believe in that. They don't agree with that.
Tears streamed down the faces of many Howard University students, like Charmanda Jean-Francois Wednesday, as Vice President Harris charged them to roll up their sleeves and keep fighting for democracy.
Kamala Harris put her energy and soul and her passion into this campaign, and she did a beautiful job with the short amount of time that she was given to run this race.
Every one of us, no matter who we are or where we start out, has certain fundamental rights and freedoms that must be respected and upheld. And we will continue to wage this fight in the voting booth, in the courts, and in the public square. Sometimes the fight takes a while. That doesn't mean we won't win. That doesn't mean we won't win. The important thing is don't ever give up. Don't ever give up. Don't ever stop trying to make the world a better place.
Many African Americans now pose the question, what does this mean for Black America? What has the impact of the presidential election left on us and our communities? What does Black resiliency look like moving forward? In today's dialogue, we'll be speaking with an expert about our mental health, a professor in African American studies on VP Harris's messaging to Black Americans, and a Democratic strategist about the divide and what went wrong in this race. Joining the conversation now is Dr. Carol Anderson. She's a Robert W. Woodruff Professor of African American Studies at Emory University. She's a New York Times best-selling author, and she's a historian. Dr. Carol Anderson, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Trump won 53% of white women, white men, and young men. He won the majority of the white vote, and Harris won 92% of black women, 78% of black men, and young voters. Harris won the majority of the black vote, and it's a tale as old as Lyndon B. Johnson. History has repeated itself in more ways than one. The mainstream narrative says it's economic anxiety, right? Like loss of jobs, struggling families. How are we going to keep food on our dinner tables? But as someone who has spent years uncovering the undercurrents of race in America, you've shown us how surface-level explanations can often mask deeper truths. What was this race really about?
It was about race and misogyny. And frankly, we saw that at the Madison Square Garden rally that Trump held, which mimicked in so many ways the Nazi Madison Square Garden rally of 1939. We heard the ways that African Americans were demeaned in terms of watermelon, in terms of playing Dixie when Byron Donalds walked onto the stage. Also in terms of the ways that Puerto Ricans were described as trash, the misogyny that just oozed out of every pore, talking about Kamala Harris's pimp handlers, the hatred that spewed out of there, that should have been as repugnant as the Access Hollywood tape was in 2016. And just the way the Access Hollywood tape, with all of its vileness, was not vile enough to stop the ascendancy of Trump because of the misogyny, the hatred against Hillary Clinton. What we saw in 2024 was that as vicious as the Madison Square Garden tape was, rally was. And then let's add to it, Haitians are eating cats and dogs. And they knew it was a lie. They were told it was a lie by Republicans, That's a lie, that is not happening. But they kept on with it. And the reason they kept on with it is because it fed a very convenient narrative, a very racist narrative. And it's the same nasty narrative we got about Venezuelans taking over Aurora, Colorado. Again, yet another lie. And when you think about when the horrible hurricane hit and then the lie came out that there wasn't enough FEMA money because the Biden administration had diverted all of that money to all of those migrants, all of those so-called illegals. I mean, again, playing to that really xenophobic fault line that's in American society, that vein that's in American society. And so when I hear that it was about economics, there was no real economic policy emanating out of that Trump campaign, except I'm going to have some tariffs. I'm going to put, you know, I don't know, 100%, 200%, 1,000% tariffs. That's not a policy. So this wasn't really about economics. The thing that was driving this pony, and they knew it, the way they kept doubling down on racism and misogyny, racism and the hatred of women, that was so powerful in this. That's what we're looking at here.
Speaking of voter suppression, in this election, we saw 13.2 million fewer voters cast their ballots. And that played a huge role. Pundits say that it wasn't even between Harris and Trump. It was between Harris and just staying at home on the couch. Dr. Anderson, what does that say about America's trust with the Democratic Party?
It says that we've got some work to do. It says that there has to be a really good analysis about why, even in the face of something as horrific as a Trump regime, that people are opting to think that American exceptionalism will somehow protect them, or that politics doesn't matter, politics doesn't touch their lives, but politics really does touch their lives. So there's a whole bunch of civic education that has to happen there. So I think about, for instance, the student loan forgiveness program, and how that was supposed to be for a broad swath of folk. And then the Republicans jumped in and stopped it. And so Biden had to figure out how to maneuver around with existing regs, how to make it happen. That's politics. And I talked to some folks who got their loans forgiven, and they're like, it was a game changer. I can now do things with my life that I wasn't able to do because I've been paying on this loan for 20 years, and I owe more now than I did when I first took the loan out. And what that means is that we have to understand the way politics touches our lives. And so when there was the child tax credit that was in place that reduced child poverty by 50%, and then the Republicans stepped in and killed that, that's politics. And so politics does touch our lives. When we get the Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS Act, and so we start seeing all of these bridges being built, all of these roads being built, we start seeing all of these manufacturing plants coming up, and so many of them in red states. That's politics. And so the jobs that are emanating from that, that's politics. And so politics really, And when we have an administration coming in talking about it wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, which provides coverage for 45 million Americans. And what that does, prior to the Affordable Care Act, if you had a pre-existing condition, insurance company could say, nah, we're not covering you, or, oh, your premiums are going to be so high, you're going to wish you got sick and just died. And so the Affordable Care Act took care of that. That was politics. And so politics is working overtime to try to get rid of it. And so some of the work that has to be done, and so we have to find the venues where to do this work. So the folks who stayed home, what is it that they listen to? What are the messages that are driving them to believe that politics doesn't affect them? What are the messages that are, or that makes them think that it doesn't matter because the system is so rigged, they're going to do what they're going to do? And without understanding the incredible power they have to bend this moral arc of the universe, the incredible power they have to insert themselves into the dynamics of politics. Because the thing is that politicians don't pay attention to you if you don't vote. If you do vote, they do pay attention because they realize that that is where their bread is buttered.
Political messaging is a huge factor. And towards the end of VP Harris's campaign cycle, she had received celebrity endorsements from the biggest names in music and entertainment. And she went on podcasts like All the Smoke and Call Her Daddy. But that didn't break through like Trump's podcast appearances seem to have. What do you think the disconnect was from Harris's messaging to the American people?
I think some of the disconnect was a broader narrative that the economy sucked, even when the economy wasn't totally sucking, and so the kind of amnesia about what Trump's economy really was, what the Biden-Harris administration had inherited, that can of just mess. My friend from Texas used to call it just mess. It was just mess. And they brought that inflation rate down. They targeted their policies on the working and middle class instead of on that kind of trickle down crap that we know hasn't worked since Reagan. They did the focus there, but the narrative we kept seeing in the media, in the mainstream media, and what I was seeing on social media was that the economy sucked eggs royal. And because eggs were so high, oh my God, going to the grocery store and getting gas, I spent $500 filling up my gas tank. And I'm like, boy, how big is your gas tank? What are you driving? I mean, but these are the stories you kept hearing over and over and over. And so that's a slight exaggeration about the $500 filling up the gas tank. But, you know, but the stories were like people spending so much money just for the basics. And this is not to say some of that wasn't happening, but it was those stories were the ones breaking through, not the stories about how wages were growing faster than the inflation rate, not the stories about how the unemployment rate had absolutely plummeted, about how there were hundreds of thousands of jobs created each quarter or each year, each month. That kind of investment in the people. So the narrative that we got was, oh, the Democrats have abandoned the working class. What that phrase says, what that phrase is really about, is the white male working class. Because the Democrats have not abandoned the working class, particularly when you see 92% of Black women voted for Kamala Harris, the vast majority of those women were working class. They knew they weren't abandoned. They knew what was being said. And so that abandoning the white male working class is, again, that power of racism and that power of misogyny and that power of the narrative. And so we've got this massive disconnect from the reality on the ground and the narrative that is out there that is just saturating the media biosphere, the information biosphere. And so I forget, somebody did a study, a recent poll, and they found that they asked somebody, so are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And they would say, yes, I'm financially better off, but my neighbors are hurting. And so it was that kind of thing because they have heard it in the biosphere. So even their own individual attainment in this kind of economy could not break through in terms of what they think is happening for everybody else. And I think that that's part of why we didn't get the her thing about moving forward, her thing about having an opportunity economy. Well, she didn't have any policies. There wasn't coherence. Yes, there was. It was about how do we open up the incredible resources of this incredible nation so that everybody could benefit. And so when you begin to think about what a $25,000 down payment for first-time home buyers, wow, building 3 million new housing units to help bring down the cost, wow. And think about the jobs that would come from building 3 million new housing units. A $6,000 child credit for your first child. Wow. I mean, so those $50,000 for business owners to start up, for business startup. There is a coherence there. The coherence is opportunity. And so it's figuring out why that wasn't heard. And to me, part of the reason why that wasn't heard is because, again, because of the power of racism, the power of misogyny, the power of not wanting to hear it, because there was already a great narrative out there. Because again, when you think about what Trump was offering, you didn't hear anything that looked like or heard sounded like coherence. You didn't hear anything that sounded like, I'm going to deal with the price of eggs. I'm going to deal with the price of housing. The way he was going to deal with the price of housing was to deport tens of millions of immigrants. That's not dealing with the price of housing. That is absolute cruelty. That is absolute racism.
Dr. Carol Anderson, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Carol Anderson. She's a Robert W. Woodruff Professor of African American Studies at Emory University. She's a New York Times best-selling author, and she's a historian. Coming up next on Dialogue, we'll be hearing from a local psychologist on the best self-care practices after this election. Stay with us on Dialogue after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. After a contentious week of the 2024 presidential elections, many African Americans posed the question, what does this mean for the future of Black America? What does it look like living in the second age of Donald Trump? Joining the conversation is journalist Tanisha Spain from Illinois Public Media. She is the Mid-American Gardener show host, and this week she sat down with Dr. Lisa Chambers, who's a psychologist and lecturer in higher education at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Parkland College.
Welcome, Dr. Lisa. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
I'd like to know, on the pre-election, what sort of things were you hearing from minorities, people of color, specifically Black people? What did this election sort of bring to the forefront that you've seen in people?
Hope, promise, concern, excitement, a whole host of different emotions that made me think that people were anticipating a positive outcome for them, because they could see themselves in Vice President Harris, especially Black women. I saw this newfound strength, especially in Black women. I saw women coming together, women raising money for this dynamic woman, the second woman to run for presidency, which is something that we didn't necessarily see the first time when Hillary Clinton ran. Money was raised. I saw a lot of positivity in mental health that I hadn't seen in a while. And it made me excited, obviously being able to identify with our vice president.
Now, have you seen people coming in wanting to talk about politics more? Let's say if they are discussing mental health, has that crept into the discussion? And that could be on the positive side, where we just talked about when the announcement came and people did have that hope. Do you see politics creeping more into people's mental health discussion?
Yes, yes, yes. From every aspect, from sadness to anxiety to tension to anger to a variety of feelings. I saw an increase in just people discovering politics and feeling good about politics and being energized and excited. There was no excitement, as much excitement when she was not a candidate. The excitement came, more conversations started, and more energy occurred once she decided to run for office.
Fast forward to election day. We're on the other side of it now. Donald Trump is the next president-elect. And you've got a lot of folks who that wasn't the outcome that they wanted. That's not the outcome that they hoped for. And dare I say, it's way more emotional than I've ever seen. I was old enough to vote for President Obama. That was a big moment. But in so many ways, this felt bigger. So when you have people who have had hope for all of this time, and then you get there and the outcome is not what you expected as a community, you know, 92% of Black women, 80 some percent of Black men, what does that do to a person? And what can we expect to feel and to think on the other side of that?
Shock. I think the election grief or the sadness because the outcome was not what over 60 million people wanted. I think that there is no comfort in that grief. And that's the problem. Many of us were feeling very charged up. And then to lose in a landslide when you had 75,000 people in crowds, when you saw the other side with minimal crowds, trying to figure out what happened. That's what I'm seeing now. More people are trying to understand it, but what we don't realize is that that's causing more anxiety, more anger, more outrage. And I would like to, at some point, discuss what we need to do about that, because I'm starting to see many people taking off work, tears. I'm here, and my phone just completely, after the election, continuously rang from friends and colleagues and different news media asking, well, what happened and what are we supposed to do and how do we handle it? So now I'm seeing more. I'm seeing Black people in particular go from feeling excited and then there's the election and then bam, everything just fell apart.
So let's get into that. These are real feelings. And I think sometimes when you and I were talking before, sometimes we don't give ourselves permission to feel that. I would love to just hear some introductory. Where do we start? Where do we start for those who are feeling it? And even if you weren't particularly invested in the candidates, the division and the, where do you start when you're trying to take care of yourself in this climate?
You know, people need to realize a couple of things. One, that the outcome was very hurtful because those of us that identify specifically as Black or Latino, we had to sit through hearing a lot of negativity, which was racism from this person that's supposed to represent all people. And that's what the president should do. One of the things that we have to do now, because we remember that and he won, is to become more resilient. And how do you become more resilient when you're upset? One of the things, the first thing I did is I shut off the media. I shut off social media. You have to set boundaries with social media and the news because it can be overwhelming. And you don't want to overwhelm yourself or saturate yourself with hearing the negative things that are still being spewed by him, still being said by those that some of the people who identify as Republican, you know, even in politics. So you want to set specific limitations in your exposure. It's kind of like with trauma. So if someone was raped, but they continue to see that person, that's re-exposing them to that trauma over and over again. And that's what you all are doing by trying to figure it out and watching the media, listening to friends who are really upset. What you have to do is you have to replace that with positive things. You have to start doing things that you enjoy. So if you like Christmas movies, even though we haven't hit Thanksgiving, it's time to start looking at Christmas movies because you're already smiling. It makes you happy thinking about those things. After a while, you'll be able to come back recharged to start being more resilient again and also getting back in the fight for equality.
You mentioned folks taking time off, and you know, we all know isolation is not a great thing, especially we're coming into these cooler, darker months. What's some advice there to just for people not to isolate and not get so caught up in feeling alone?
As far as mental health goes, I'm okay if people need to take time off just to kind of be realistic with how you feel. You always want to be realistic about how you feel because we get into trouble when we don't do that. When we say to ourselves, oh, we're okay, we're going to continue to go to work, I'm sad, but I'm just going to brush it off, we create more anxiety. Our bodies can't help. Our bodies cannot take the amount of anxiety sometimes that we put on ourselves, and we start getting sick, we start shutting ourselves down. Our body will let us know that it's too much. So if you have to take a day off work, you have to take 2 days off of work to manage your stress, that's fine. But what I would like to see you do is to get back going to work, because the way to change your brain is to actually take action. So you get back up and you go back to work. You go back around people. You start to find safe gathering spaces, your friends and family, where you can talk about these things. You start to educate yourself and you build awareness around the things that are important to you for this. For example, in your community, there are probably several associations that you can join that will continue your fight in this battle. For example, the NAACP, there are sororities and fraternities in the area that are probably going to start doing some type of programs to manage our stress. You want to stay connected. So you want to find your tribe, people that will help you and inspire you to get through this process.
I've even heard it from relatives who will say, I don't understand why everybody's so upset. How does a person who is really feeling this, what is a good way for them to make people understand, I'm not in the same space as you? What's some good language to use there?
There are people who won't understand how you feel. And that's just the bottom line. You have to find people who do understand, where you can amplify your voice and your voice can be heard and your voice can be safe. There are people who don't understand. I don't know if it's because they didn't think she would win the election, or they are people who suppress their feelings, but that's not the feeling for the majority of people, the majority of us who are very upset about it. So what I would say, if your friends and family aren't quite understanding your feelings, I want you to go and find a place where you can engage with people who do. And that could be social media. You know, even though I want you to set parameters around the type of content that you view via social media, there are still groups on social media where you can actively engage with to help you to understand why you feel that way. You know, I think that group therapy is some of the best therapy that we have, because you have a lot of people around you who may feel the same, but not only do they understand it, but they will help you to fight through it because they've probably been there and want to lend a voice to you to help you.
Excellent. Now, I'm thinking now about the holiday season. We've got Thanksgiving and Christmas coming up. We're all about to get together. Is it worth to you at this point, if you've got two opposing opinions, is it beneficial to try to discuss these, to try to find headway with the other person? Give us some tips to survive these holiday gatherings.
I'll tell you how I'm going to survive. You know, I think it's case by case. It depends on the type of conversation you're going to have. If you know that it's a negative conversation, it's a topic you do not want to be a part of, then you have every right to set those boundaries for yourself. You pick up on the social cues immediately and put the boundaries around yourself and tell people you are not going to engage in the conversation. It's too soon for some people to hear any type of negative feedback about what happened One thing that I find is that a lot of people want to talk about what was done wrong by the Democrats. And I see negative reactions to that because I think it's too soon to try to get the community who supported Vice President Harris to open up to say what happened. Some of us are still trying to decrease our symptoms that we had over her loss. Just tell people, no, I don't want to talk about it, and don't. Be okay with saying no to other people.
To take care of yourself.
That be okay with that, even with family. I know it's hard to do, but be okay with saying no.
Excellent advice. And you talked earlier about doing things, getting back to things that you love. You know, this is sort of our first, the election is the first blush of this, but as we march toward the inauguration and the actual presidency, what's some long-term advice for folks to find their stride, bring that energy back up as we just continue to settle into our new reality?
Well, I'm going to always promote physical health, always. The part about physical health that we tend to forget is mental health. When you manage your stress through a healthy body and a healthy mind, what happens? Your mental health is improved. There's a ton of research that shows when we exercise, for example, we tend to decrease symptoms of mental health. So I always advocate for having great physical health. The other thing you want to do is you do want to stay connected to the community. You don't want to stay away at all from the community, because you, once you feel better, once you take the time to set your boundaries, you want to start engaging back in the community. You want to deal with local activism. You want to volunteer your time, even if you volunteer with things that are outside of politics. You want to do these things that support various causes that matter to you. Now, as far as mental health goes, you also, if you just can't control the symptoms, the sadness, if it's too much, if it's happening every day, if you feel like you're in a dark place, it's okay to find a mental health practitioner who specializes in cultural sensitivities to, they understand Black culture and sensitivities and how these things truly impact, you know, Black people. So you can do those things.
Any advice on just small self-care actions? What can I do if I'm looking in the mirror, and, you know, anybody, or maybe not even the mirror, but as we maybe slide back and forth, because it's not linear, right? So
right.
If you find yourself getting into one of those despondent moments, or what is something quickly you can do in the moment that's a nice little self-care to maybe turn your day around, turn that moment around?
I'll share with you, one of the reasons I started writing up my blogs, even for Psychology Today, that was my way of releasing my tension, to dealing with my feelings. Writing is a great thing to do. You can keep a journal next to your bed. You can write out all of your feelings. You can lay that anxiety right down in a journal and start to sleep better, because you get everything off of your chest. Mindfulness is something else that's very useful. And mental health professionals that specialize in mindfulness can teach you about those things. You can do other personal wellness routines outside of exercising. One of the things that I like to do is travel. You can get back into different things that you like to do. Most of us do have people that we can talk to. Let them know how you feel. Sometimes we will not only isolate ourselves, but we won't talk to people that are close to us about how we feel. So we can lean on other people in our immediate circle to help us, friends, colleagues. And so those are some immediate things that you can do, you know, to help yourself through the situation.
I mean, humans are resilient. So we're going to get there, right? We people just need to hear that.
Well, taking care of yourself is being resilient. I think I already said that to you, but I'm going to say it again, because we are designed to handle emotions, all of us. Our bodies are designed to handle it. We will get through this within our bodies. One day we'll wake up and we'll forget about the stress and the concern and the anxiety and the anger and the rage, and we won't be as shocked because we had this already. in 2016. So we know what to expect, even if there's more that's going to happen with this term. We are already prepared to handle it. We are strong people. And yes, we will be okay.
Speaking specifically to the Black community, I've done segments with other mental health professionals who say we don't do the best job at giving ourselves permission to feel that full range. Right. Can you talk a little bit about that and the history behind it? But how do we escape that cycle?
We have to make a conscious effort to break it. It's the easiest way to do it, but it's also hard because society also, in particular with Black women, thinks that we are invincible. I just wrote an article about that. And it is a false perception of women, however we feed into it, Black women, because we do give the impression of, I'm going to be sad, but we're going to keep going. We can do this. You know, we've had no choice but to be strong. And that's what people forget. You know, we can be sad. You know, we can be very anxious about things, but society will view us as not having feelings, or that we're invincible, that we wear a cape on our chest and that we can survive anything, because we have, and we've shown that resiliency. But it's time for us to decrease that and truly embrace our mental health, and that we are not invincible, and that we do cry, and that when we are too stressed, it gives us heart conditions, which is the leading cause of death in Black women. So we do have to not only say no, but to set boundaries with regard to how much we're going to take and what we're going to do about it. I have a personal plan for myself. When I feel like I'm doing too much, I stop. And that's because I care about my mental health. And I tell people no, that I start cutting back on things that I can't do because it's too much and I can feel it. We have to pay attention to our body to manage it. And we're so used to sometimes being tired, and we keep going even when we're tired. We don't take care of ourselves, but you have to realize that you come first, because if we are not okay, what's the old cliche? If mama's not okay, nobody's okay. And that is true.
Kids are hearing these conversations. Kids are seeing their parents have feelings and react. So anything there to say about our kids and what we should be doing for them and their mental health?
Of course, we should tell them the truth. That's a part of research too. Kids are going through different things and they watch us go through it. We tend to want to protect them from death to politics. We need to tell kids the truth. One thing that Vice President Harris did teach us is that you lose with grace.
What is normal in regards to our sadness? We talked about seeing a mental health professional if you feel like you need to, but how long is too long to be sad?
That's a good question. Election grief. That's what it's called. Election grief. And so any grief, any sadness, however, you got to normalize sadness versus depression. We all get sad. We all aren't depressed. Depression is different. But I would say my hope is that no one will be clinically depressed over the election. But if you are, a year is too long. And that is clinical depression, someone being feeling dark and sad, helpless, hopeless. For me personally, 3 months is too long, but we do have, you know, criteria that we have to use to diagnose depression. Sadness is different because everyone feels sad. Everyone grieves. Everyone loses trust. This is a situation where we lost trust. Not just in the election process, but in how people perceive us. Those things are typical with grief. You have denial, you have anger, you have bargaining. This can't be true. She couldn't have lost the election. Then you have sadness or depression. And you also have acceptance, accepting. We're not there yet. We're getting to the point where we're going to have to start accepting the outcome. So you monitor yourself. If other people around you, or if you start to feel as if you are in a dark place, and I mean literally dark, where you can't see anything but darkness, you are feeling hopeless, sad, suicidal, helpless, then it's time to get help.
collectively, as everyone, you know, tries to move forward, is there anything I didn't touch on or any other tidbits or tips that you would like to offer folks who may just not be feeling it?
Yeah, process your feelings of disappointment. It's all right. I think it's a great thing to do that. I've had to do that. Other people have had to do that around me. If you're frustrated, be frustrated. Allow yourself to rest and become renewed, because we still need you, because we still have a finish line here. It's not finished. Not finished at all. Take an emotional and mental break from all of it. Make sure you do that to help you come back with a clearer perspective and also fresh energy, because we still need your energy.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lisa, for joining us on this episode of Dialogue.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That was IPM's Tanisha Spain with Dr. Lisa Chambers. She's a psychologist and lecturer in higher education. If you are in need of help, you can call the Suicide Prevention Hotline at 988. Coming up next on Dialogue, we'll be hearing from Cornell Belcher. He's a Democratic pollster and founder of Brilliant Corners Research and Strategies. Stay with us on Dialogue after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. Joining the conversation now is Cornell Belcher. He's a Democratic pollster, a MSNBC contributor, and founder of Brilliant Corners Research and Strategies. Cornell Belcher, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Speaking of some of the incredible work that you've done in your career, the modeling of the Obama coalition in 2008 and 2012, it was a broad base of support with white working class voters. Obama won Indiana in 2008, and that would be unthinkable today. Is that coalition over? Is the possibility of building a coalition with both African Americans and the white working class dead and over?
This is about sort of the composition of the electorate, right? And I would actually start before 2008, and I would start in 2004 and level set for folks here. And so in 2004, Republicans had a sweeping victory, and some Republicans, including Bush's chief Republican advisor, they were literally talking about a permanent Republican majority. What happened? A guy by the name of Howard Dean came in, and he ran for chair of the DNC, and we won. And I worked for Howard Dean, and Howard Dean came up with this crazy idea that we have to, in fact, build a 50-state strategy, that we need to be talking to people and expand the electorate. We need to bring more people into the process. Election night in 2008, you know, David Plouffe famously said, we're not going to be sitting around waiting for the results of one state to come in for us to understand, know who's going to be president, because we're going to have multiple pathways. And we brought a lot of new people into the process. Approximately 11% of the vote in 2008 were people who were not what we call regular voters. They were more sporadic or new voters. And they were key to Obama's winning even then, because if you look at just the vote of the voters who were consistent, most likely voters, even then John McCain would have won that. So it's about the contours of the electorate. When talking about this working class white and black coalition, you know, how deep do you want to go in this conversation? Because frankly, what Trump has tapped into is a part of the continuum of why I would argue there's never been a black, brown, and white working class coalition in this country. To understand the Southern strategy and what Atwater built with the Southern strategy was to divide whites from blacks, right? And to use racial aversion to make sure that that there's never going to be a coalition of working class people across color lines. That holds true, right? I, you know, when I hear so many of my progressive colleagues talk about, well, if we just simply have another economic, better economic message to reach out to these voters, here's a fundamental problem with that. They're eating cats and dogs. It's not an economics message, right? When you come down, when you say Mexicans are rapists and gang members, you're not making an economic argument. When Donald Trump stood in front of his rallies, at least in 2016, and he talked about, I'm going to give you back your country, right? He's not talking about raising the minimum. That's not about minimum wage raising, right? That's not about an economic message. So I think some of my progressive friends, their blind spot is race. And it's something that's painful for them to talk about. And it's something that's hard to solve for. But I am weary and suspect of any analysis coming out of this election cycle where the variable of racial and sexism are not a key component of that, right? And the othering and the fear mongering, which is again a playbook right out of the Southern strategy, right out of Atwater's playbook, why so many of my progressive friends want to ignore that, I think is really problematic. Now, that said, here's the power of the Southern strategy still today. Donald Trump lost in 2020. And as opposed to like the Democratic strategists, air quotes now, are saying, you know, we got to fundamentally change, we got to fundamentally move in a different direction. Donald Trump did not. He lost by a large share of votes. And what did they do? They doubled down on the Southern strategy. They doubled down on this racial aversion.
Cornell Belcher, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Thank you for having me. I hope that my little 2 cents, my piece, has helped add to an understanding of our country and our elections.
That was Cornell Belcher, a Democratic pollster, an MSNBC contributor, and the founder of Brilliant Corners Research and Strategies. You can find the Dialogue podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. And you can give us a follow on Instagram and Facebook at Illinois Soul. This episode of Dialogue was produced by Zainab Qureshi, Troy McDonald, and myself, Kennedy Vincent. Our news and public affairs director is Reginald Hardwick, and production assistance by Steve Mork. Dialogue is a part of Illinois Soul and Illinois Public Media. Join us for our next dialogue every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and Tuesday night at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul FM 101.1 and WILL AM 580 Wednesdays at 8 p.m.